That was a nice shot. Welcome. You're taking Dead Aim with Charlie Nance. Taking Dead Aim is sponsored by RBC Wealth Management. Now, here's the host of Taking Dead Aim, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. It's the weekend before Thanksgiving, and if this finds you traveling, number one, thanks for joining us. Number two, be safe. Look, family and friends want you to get there, and they don't care if you're a little late or behind schedule. So just take your time and be courteous and aware of all the other drivers around you who, guess what? They're just looking to do the same thing as you. This week on the show, we look back on a couple of memorable conversations we had. One with Jack Nicklaus II, Jackie Nicklaus, who is much more than just his father's eldest son. But we begin today with a chat we had last month with country music superstar and Jordan Spieth's Pebble Beach Pro-Am partner, Jake Owen.
All right, so we've known each other an awful long time, and I'll never forget a statement you made to me early on. You said, if I go back for my 10-year reunion and you were to poll everyone in my class, what is more likely, that Jake Owen was going to be singing in front of thousands of fans doing country music, or Jake was going to be a professional golfer? Everyone would have laughed at the notion of you being a singer, correct?
Yeah, totally, totally.
How did you get involved with the game? I know you've had a lifelong affair with it.
Well, my dad was an amazing, is still an amazing player, great player. But as a kid, he was just, it was just one of those things he was really great at. And I think as a son, you just want to be like your dad. And, so anytime I'd ask him if I could go with him, he'd let me go, you know, ride around in the golf cart. And even if it was his round of golf with his buddies, every now and then he'd say, he'd throw a ball down on the ground and say, here, hit it, here, keep your head down, you know, put your grip over here a little bit. And so I got into it at a young age, and then now here I am. I just turned 27.
Excuse me.
But I, yeah, and I still play thanks to my dad. He got me in it early.
I know you have a twin brother, Jared. Did he play? Are you guys competitive at golf?
Jared's, yeah, we're competitive at everything, but he, Jared's a pretty good player. He's just a good athlete, so he's pretty great.
How old were you the first time you beat your dad?
Probably like 14 or 15.
Did he let you win?
No, he didn't. He never let me win at anything. We had a pool table in our house growing up, and that's how I learned to play pool pretty good, is because my dad would never let us win, and Jared and I would play and play and play every day until I think I was right around 13 or 14 when I beat my dad for the first time in pool. That was a pretty big deal, too. We're just a competitive family.
With what we do for a living and with what you do for a living, I know that we've had the opportunities and to do lots of fun stuff in golf, but I know that one of the biggest thrills you ever had was the afternoon that you got to take your dad and go play at Augusta National. Tell me about that.
It was amazing. We're actually getting ready to go back, which is cool. I'm going to take my twin brother with us this time, so we have the family affair, which will be great. But it was great. It was really cool. And I mean, it's one of those things that you just, you know, it's a lifelong dream that came true, and something that I will always cherish forever.
Bigger thrill, the first time you played the Grand Ole Opry or playing with your dad at Augusta National?
Oh, playing with my dad at Augusta National for sure. I mean, Grand Ole Opry, no disrespect. I love the Grand Ole Opry, but I mean, that's more selfish for me. You know, I mean, that was about me and everything I worked for in my career of music. But as far as a lifelong dream, I think we all just want to spend special moments with our parents, and to be able to go to, you know, heaven on earth of golf, of Augusta National, and play with my dad was, I mean, I could have, if someone would have said, here's a contract that you can play Augusta National with your father, and the following day will be, you know, your last day on earth, I would be like, all right, tell me where to sign. Like, that's cool.
Jake Owen is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. I've referred to you privately to people as America's favorite pro-am guest. You have gotten, I love to follow you playing golf in pro-ams around the country. I'm going to hit a couple of them here. Let's start in Phoenix at the Waste Management. How fun, how wild is that environment?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it's, I've played a lot of golf tournaments, and I'd say Phoenix is the most wild party atmosphere for a golf tournament. And the last few years, I've played with some great players. I mean, I play with Jordan Spieth, and I are obviously really close. We play at Pebble Beach together, so we've played at Phoenix. And I played with a couple other guys that are pretty great as well. This past year, I played with Daniel Berger, who's an amazing player, and Harris English, great player. But yeah, Phoenix is more than just a golf tournament. It's a party with a golf tournament going on inside of the party.
Last year, you brought up Pebble Beach. Last year, you won the Arnie Award. I was very happy for you. I think because more than anything else, I knew how much it meant to you because of your dad. Talk to me about what that award is and what it was like to accept it with your dad there.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. It was really, really special because to me, Arnold Palmer is not only just someone I've admired growing up as a golfer, but he's someone that I think we can all aspire to be like professionally because of the way he took care of his fans, the way he held himself as a man. You know, he was a strong guy that was a guy's guy, but he respected women. He was married to the same lady his whole career. She stood by his side. He stood by her side. And he just always, when he won with class, and when he lost with class. And to be given an award in his name that is really given to represent the kind of character that someone is, their charitable efforts, the kind of person they are, how they carry themselves, and for me to look up to Arnold that way, and then be given an award, not only just that award at Pebble Beach, but the other two that same night was Peyton Manning and Phil Mickelson. Of us, the three of us together on stage accepting this award in Arnold's name, was surreal, man. And then to cap that off with the fact that my dad was there to watch it, and I'm standing next to arguably one of the top five greatest golfers of all time and arguably the greatest quarterback of all time, accepting an award based off one of the greatest golfers again of all time, and to his standards and the class that he carried, and to think that people revere me in that same light is the word unbelievable is cliche to use, but it really truly is unbelievable. I still look at that trophy in my house every day when I walk by it when I'm home, and it kind of not only is special for me, but it's also a reminder of what the kind of standards I have to hold myself to. If people think that much of me to give me that award, I have to remind myself, just like any other human being, that I mean, I've got to live up to that. You know, I don't make great decisions all the time, and I think just like Arnold, he was a human being, but he found a way daily to strive to be the best human being he could be, and that's kind of what I try to do. And that award really reminds me to be that every day.
Jake Owen is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. You talk about surreal moments. I would think, you know, we all get up in the morning, we look in the mirror, we don't put ourselves on any kind of pedestal or anything. I know how you are. When you go to the Pebble Beach Pro-Am, and you've been there, I guess, 3, 4, 5 times now, are there moments where you look around and you look at some of the people and you're like, holy crap, I'm standing here at a bar next to Clint Eastwood. Do you still have those moments?
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. It's to me, that's probably the most fun week of my life every year, just because I get to go out there with family, spend time with them, and I get to pretend I'm a professional golfer, which I always wanted to be anyways. And then I get to play music with people that I genuinely enjoy and admire as well. I mean, each year, I mean, last year I was up on stage playing with like Toby Keith and, I mean, Andy Garcia, the actor, is there, crazy, having fun. Kenny G's playing his saxophone and whatever else he is. He's playing the clarinet. And like you said, I mean, you've got guys, every Kid Rock's hanging around. You've got Clint Eastwood. That's all amongst guys, like I said, like Jordan Spieth and Jason Day and the greatest golfers in the world. And what's cool is we all have a appreciation for what we all do. But when you're out there, it's all kind of put aside, and we're there just to have a good time, and it's really fun.
I want to ask you about that final day because it was interesting to me. Jordan wins the tournament. You guys, I think, finished third in the Pro-Am, but in that final pairing on that final day, you're in a group with Jordan Spieth and Dustin Johnson, two of the top 3-4 golfers in the world, however you want to rank it. You're a really good golfer, and by that I mean with a couple of weeks' preparation, you can go win any club championship you want. You've been scratch or better, despite whatever the hell you tell Pebble Beach, that 7 handicap, give me a break.
Two,
okay. But anyway, when you're with those guys, just tell everybody, as good as you are, how great those guys really are, that you're sitting there looking at them going, this is not happening.
I mean, it's just a different level, you know. I mean, those guys don't miss. They, you know, us as usual, you know, and I appreciate you saying I'm a great, good golfer. I mean, I'm okay. I mean, staying around a 2 or 3 handicap without practicing ever really is kind of – pretty cool for me. If I practice, I get.
Well, that's what I'm saying. With a couple of weeks, you could get it going.
The difference is, even if I practiced and I got down to a scratch golfer, there's going to be multiple times throughout a round where I go, dang it, and I block a drive right, or I flub a wedge short of the green. You know what I mean? Or you leave one in the bunker or whatever. Those guys don't do that. Like, when they get in a bunker, their thought is, I'm going to make this. They're not like, our thought is, don't leave this in the bunker or don't chunk it, right? Their thought every single time they hit a golf shot is, how can I put this golf ball in the hole? And I've seen it firsthand with Jordan. I mean, he'll have a 40-yard chip shot, and he's analyzing the green breaking so he can make it. I mean, he's not thinking, let me get this close so I can make par. He's like, how do I make this shot so I can gain a shot on the field? You know, and that to me is amazing. They don't miss.
What is something that you're able to get from them as far as watching how they perform at the highest level of what they do and translate it to the highest level of what you do?
I think what I notice the most from those guys is that they're patient. You know, where we as amateur golfers are having fun playing golf, drinking beers with our buddies. We hop out of the golf cart. We go, how far is it? Oh, it's 149. Okay, cool. Grab me an 8-iron and then, you know, swing it. These guys are being deliberate. They look at their target. They step back. They look at the wind. They take a few practice swings. And then what I really notice is when they step over the golf ball, they don't hit that shot unless they're fully committed to where their target is and their tempo and their posture. And I hear their caddies. They'll sit their caddy right before the hill. Every time Jordan's caddy, Mike Greller, will say, all right, good tempo, good posture. Good tempo, good posture. And I'd hear that a lot. And it's good to think, you know, because the thing in golf is if you don't set yourself up in a good athletic position, you're not giving yourself, you know, a good chance. And especially if you're not aimed at the right target. If you don't know where you're aimed at, then it's not going to go there. My dad always said that. He said, if you're going to drive somewhere and you don't know where you're headed, how do you know when you get there? And so to me, the biggest importance between us as amateurs and professional golfers is their attention to detail, their patience, and consistency with picking a target, and their consistency of their tempo and their golf swing. It never changes. Their putter is the same as their driver.
Get you out of here. This Jake Owen is our guest taking Dead Aim. You got to do something that I thought was pretty cool, and I didn't know you were doing it. It was sort of a side mention by a commentator. Tell me about going out to Idaho and the Solheim Cup, and how crazy was that?
Oh, yeah, that was weird. Not weird. It was just weird to be a part of, you know, it's pretty cool. I've never spent much time around LPGA golf. And those girls are so great. I mean, I watched Brittany Lincecum make like 6 birdies in a row, and I've played my entire life. I've never made 5 in a row, much less 6. And she did it like it was no big deal. And that's what I think is so great about today's world and the opportunities that guys and girls are having at a young age to get out there and hone in on their craft. And thankfully, to golf being a bigger sport, people are gravitating towards it. And it's pretty cool. My little girl, I got videos of her the other day taking golf lessons. So, you know, who knows? You know, maybe she'll be out there one day.
He's got a greatest hits CD due out by the end of the year and new music from a brand new record label coming in 2018. And of course, he'll be teeing it up at Pebble Beach with Jordan Spieth this February. That's the one and only Jake Owen. Up next, part one of our conversation from the summer with Jack Nicklaus II. Jackie, taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management. We are taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management. Jack Nicklaus II is best remembered to golf fans as the eldest son of the greatest of all time, who was memorably on the bag in Augusta in 1986. But as I found out this summer, Jackie Nicklaus is much, much more than that. Jack, I'm going to start with a question that I'm betting no one has asked you, or at least not asked you recently. How young were you when you realized how special Barbara Nicklaus is?
Well, you threw me off. I thought you were going to ask me about Jack Nicklaus. Good for you. guys, you did catch me off guard with that. You know what? I can answer it in a number of different ways, but I'm still realizing what a wonderful lady Barbara Nicklaus is. She's doing so much today. For the Nicklaus Children's Hospital and here during the Memorial Tournament this week for the Nationwide Children's Hospital. And, you know, she dedicates her time to helping people. She's so kind always to everybody. Doesn't matter who it is or where they're from. She is just complete kindness and just wants to help. Her memory is insane. She remembers details about people that when I have a tough time remembering a first name, she remembers full names, children, grandchildren's names. I mean, and she keeps in touch with everybody. I can go on and on, but I will say this. There's no question my dad's career would not have been what it has been without my mom supporting him. She kept everything in order in his life. She managed us kids, managed the household. There's no question that without her support, there wouldn't have been the career that Jack Nicklaus has had.
Seriously, though, you're the first of your parents' five children. Do you remember when it might have occurred to you that people didn't treat your dad or your family the same ways that other people's families were treated? At what point in your life did it become apparent to you that I'm in sort of a different situation here?
Well, I think my mom and dad, like I say, sheltered us from that, but they did not thrust us out in the limelight. They kept us very grounded. And they taught us good principles and fundamentals and good morals. It's just, my dad was in the public eye, but I can go back to some. Little things that I said, someone apparently, I don't remember, but apparently I said when I was about 6 years old, when asked, what does your dad do for work? And my response was, oh, he doesn't work. He just plays golf. And, it was never a big deal. At least mom and dad never made it a big deal. And they were always at all of our sporting events. And honestly, we didn't see ourselves as any different than anybody else.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is something that I've always admired from afar. The priority that your parents made of being parents. In fact, I remember watching your nephew play at FSU a few years ago in bowl games and seeing your folks in the crowd. And they looked so satisfied and so comfortable in the role of just being Nick O'Leary's grandparents. And I was trying to think how to put this. Arnold Palmer always wanted to be recognized as Arnold Palmer. And that's not a bad thing. And that's not a knock on Arnold. But am I correct in saying that when your parents would show up at your ball game or at a recital for your sister or at Nick O'Leary's football games, they were more than happy and content in the skin of just being mom and dad or grandparents?
I think that's a really accurate statement. Arnold, I love Arnold Palmer, and he's so dearly missed. But I think Arnold was really comfortable in a room of 500 people that he hadn't met. They were soon going to be his friends. And I think my mom and dad would more gravitate to smaller groups and maybe a more intimate setting. Everyone's wired a little bit differently, but Arnold and my dad, boy, they had an amazing friendship over the years. But to get back to the role of grandparents and parents, they have completely embraced that. He was at Nick O'Leary's. My mom and dad were at Nick O'Leary's events. In fact, I don't know that they missed a single college football game,
wow,
home or away, in the 4 years that Nick was at Florida State. They're at Buffalo Bills a lot, watching him play. But that's one of 22 grandkids. My mom and dad often have to split their time up, mom going one direction, dad the other, so they can attend all the kids' games. I mean, that has been a priority for mom and dad. And it was the same way when we were growing up. I cannot recall many events that mom and dad missed. Mom was our scorekeeper in our basketball games. Dad was often on the roof of the gym overlooking the football field, calling down plays to our coach. I mean, they were very involved with our lives. And I can remember our football team, my brother Steve and I were playing out west of Lake Okeechobee against our crosstown rival. And, it's a very difficult place to get to. That was a Friday night game. My dad was playing the World Series of Golf up in Akron, Ohio. And he played his round. He was lucky enough to play that morning, got on a plane, flew down into this remote area west of Lake Okeechobee. Got to our game before kickoff. Wished us good luck. Watched our game. I will mention we won the game. And he slapped us on the butt, said, nice game. We'll see you guys Sunday night. Got on the plane, flew back to Akron. I'm sure he got back at, 2 in the morning. And I wish I could tell you he won the tournament, but I don't think he did that year. But that's the type of sacrifices that that they've made for us that really have made an impact in our lives. And, such a great role model for myself as a parent.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. I want to ask about your sister just for a second, Nick O'Leary's mom. You have three brothers and you have a sister. And I would think, even in an age, and I think you were really lucky in that you grew up when you did, I think it would be so tough to be Jack Nicklaus's kid right now with social media and with the constant scrutiny and the 24-hour golf channels. I think the pressure would be immense. I'm not saying it wasn't pressure-filled. But your sister had it a lot easier from a pressure standpoint being Jack Nicklaus's daughter than you guys did being Jack Nicklaus's sons. Is that correct?
Well, I think we all... we all had our own experiences. I think there's a lot of positives and there's some negatives. When it comes right down to it, we all had great parents, and we're lucky we still have great parents. Nan has done a great job with her five kids. She played sports. Matter of fact, she probably had the best golf swing of any of my siblings, but she just never really played. She played volleyball at the University of Georgia, and my parents went and watched her play there, like she did with all of us. I don't know that I'd say she had it easier or tougher. I think we're all in kind of the same boat, and we've all been very supportive of each other.
Speaking of your playing career, and I guess I had sort of forgotten. For those that may have forgotten like me, Jack Nicklaus II had a hell of an amateur career. Like his father, he won the North-South Amateur, which to me, look, there's the U.S. Amateur and there's the North-South Amateur. That's how much I think of that tournament. And you won it in 1985, but I was looking at the years surrounding 1985. Listen to some of these names that put their name on that trophy. Hal Sutton, Corey Pavin, Keith Clearwater, Davis Love III, Jack Nicklaus II, Billy Andrade. That's six or seven names out of 8 years. That's a heck of a time in amateur golf in this country, huh?
Oh, I had a really lucky week. It was so much
stop.
Fun. I had so much fun. It was kind of neat. My dad was on his way to the Memorial Tournament, which in fact we're playing this week, and so he's on his way up. I'm sure he thought that I'd, maybe not qualify for match play, and I did. And I think he probably thought I'd maybe get beaten the first round, and I won the first round. And what happened, he eventually ran out of clothes. He called my mom each night. He says, well, Jackie won again today, and I'm going to have to get some more clothes. And I think by the week's end, he had no anticipation of being there, through the finals. And, of course, he was there. He watched every shot that was played, and I think he was probably worn out by the time he got to the Memorial Tournament. But it was a really fun time and to play college golf and amateur golf. And I feel really blessed that I got to rub shoulders with some of those great players. And, I never had the next career like those guys did. But, I'm probably getting off on tangents. But at the time, Davis Love, we played on the same team in North Carolina. He was a dominant player, but probably the most dominant player that time was Scott Verplank. And Scott was out of Oklahoma State, and he was one of those guys that was so good you just couldn't understand it. And I remember I had won the North South on Sunday, I believe it was, and that night I flew down to Greenleaf near Orlando in Florida to play the NCAAs. And I remember walking on to the tee, and I was always in awe of Scott Verplank, and Oklahoma State was warming up, and Scott stopped his warm-up, turned around, and started clapping for me. And that really meant a lot to me. It still does. I mean, that was just a really nice thing to do for somebody that, was the king of amateur golf at the time, to recognize, me for something that I had done. It was really the first major victory that I had, you know, ever had in amateur golf, really.
Scott Verplank, always known for being a classy guy, and that
he's
story really illustrates it. Jack Nicklaus II is our guest, taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. So let me do some timeline work here. If you are the reigning North-South amateur champion in 1985, when you're on the bag in 86, you're still the North-South champion, and you're caddying at the Masters? I mean, at some point, do you not look at your old man and say, get somebody else, I'm the North-South champ, Pop?
Oh, that well, I was. I had a chance, had I played a little bit better in the fall of 85, I would have made the Walker Cup, and I would have been playing in the 86 Masters had that happened. I played in the British Amateur later that year, and I got beat in the quarterfinals by David Curry. He ended up winning the tournament, and oddly enough, I saw David Curry at the Masters in 86. So, I think had I made the Sweet 16 at the Western Amateur, that was another hurdle that would have gotten me into the Masters. So, rather than playing in the Masters that year, I got to caddy. But boy, what a ride that was at 86.
He is Jack Nicklaus II, and when we return, much more from Jackie, including his thoughts on that magical weekend in Augusta as he takes Dead Aim at the 1986 Masters and more, presented by RBC Wealth Management. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management, and we continue our conversation with Jack Nicklaus II. You know, we all remember that, of course, and I really enjoyed the Golf Channel did a tremendous piece on the 30th anniversary last year where we learned a couple of things that I had never heard before. But in the moment, when you were in it, when your dad and you were in it, and immediately after it was done, did you realize how big it was or how big it was going to become over time?
I didn't realize how big it was going to become, but I knew it was really big at the time. Dad hadn't won for several years. It was my first time caddying for my dad at Augusta. I'd caddied for him many times prior to that. And it was a growing significance throughout the week, but particularly on Sunday, a little bit on the front nine, but really on the back nine, when he started gaining some momentum and the crowd really rallied behind him, the applause that he got was just amazing. They embraced him, and it was an embrace not just for what he was doing that particular Sunday afternoon, but I really felt it was an embrace for what he has meant to the game of golf, what he's, you know, meant for, you know, so many people as a role model. He embodied so much that is good, that the people, I think they appreciated what he was doing that day, and they appreciated what he had done throughout his career. And there was such a well of emotions as my dad approached every green and every tee. I could see him tear up at every junction, and it was amazing that he could regroup and perform. And, certainly it culminated into, you know, a hug that was very natural on the 18th green that I'll remember forever.
Now, that hug was very public. And then, of course, you have the multiple ceremonies of the green jacket. You have the dinner with the members afterwards. And there's a lot of hoo-ha that goes on after the Masters that no one really knows about. And it's not till later that evening when perhaps you get back to the residence that you guys had rented in Augusta for that day. Or maybe it even came later. That first moment, privately, when it's just you and your dad, what was said?
Honestly, I don't know. I don't know that there was a lot of discussion. I mean, by that time you're exhausted. They put the green coat on. Well, let me back up. You're in the heat of it. You know, I'm just trying to not to screw up as a caddy. My dad's hitting these great golf shots, and he finishes, and signs a scorecard, and they take him over to the Jones cabin, which is just to the left of the 10th tee. And it's the first time I'd seen my dad nervous the entire day and my dad explained that to me later. He said he felt like he could control his destiny all day long up until the point where he holed out his last putt. At that point, it was out of his hands. He did all that he could do, and he was nervous. And, we had the TV on, and he was kind of pacing back and forth behind the couch in the small room there at the center of the Jones cabin. But, we didn't talk a lot. we were just intent on seeing what was going to happen. And, of course, you know, when Kite missed a close putt and Greg Norman had the pitch out at 18 and missed a putt on the green as well, that's at that moment we knew that Dad had won the Masters. And we all had a great embrace. His sister, Marilyn, was there. And it was just, and his mom and my mom and myself, just our group was in that room. And it was a great embrace and happiness. And then, of course, they escorted him right out to, you know, meet the crowd and to the cheers. And and at that point, what happens is, you know, they do the coat ceremony, and then there's a small ceremony after that with some of the members. And then, frankly, we got on an airplane and came back home that night. So we probably got home at, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning. So there was probably more sleep than talk.
At that point in your career as a player, you mentioned you were playing in Carolina. You were the North-South Amateur Champion. In a private game in South Florida at that point, had you beaten your dad?
Yes, but maybe 1 out of 100 times.
but you had done it. So you could say, hey, I've beaten the Masters Champion.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
But again, you know, I learned early on, Charlie, that we played a lot of golf. And my brother Gary and I both learned if we were up on him at all, we might have him 1 or 2 up with a couple of holes to play. And every time we brought that to my dad's attention, I'm telling you what, putts went in the hole from all directions. I mean, he had a switch that he could just turn on. So we learned not to bring it up. And occasionally we got to the last hole without him realizing we might have him 1 up. But again, that was not very often.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. I know you're involved with the Nicklaus Design Company. You had your own design business for a while. And to me, I think this is a supreme talent. I've never understood. I have friends that can walk into old houses and old architecture and go, if I take this wall out here and do this and this, I can. And I never can see that. And the ability to be able to walk out on an expanse of land, a piece of property, and envision a golf course, I think that's an incredible talent and an incredible vision. Is that something you were born with, or is that something that you were taught by your dad? How did you develop that skill?
You know what? I think it's a learned skill. I've always enjoyed, you know, the artwork part of it, you know, drawing and whatnot. But I've followed my dad around for years and years, and ever since I can remember. You know, here at Muirfield Village, he did this golf course. We opened in 74. He started the design in 72. So that would have put me about 10 years old at the time. And I followed him around. And I listened and I watched, and he'd ask my opinion as I grew up. And it's just, I felt like for me it was a learned skill. I love the work. Matter of fact, you did mention I had my own design group. I have my own design jobs, but I've always worked under the Nicklaus Design Company.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so my dad and I have been a partner on a lot of jobs. And I can't tell you how amazed I am with his ability to see things, just like you were explaining. I oftentimes get caught up in minutia and not, you know, as they say, see a tree through the forest. Well, he seems to be seeing a project from 20 and 30,000 feet really, really well. And he's got such a creative mind. And I've tried to just listen and learn best I can, because I don't think there's anybody better than him in the business. And it's really been a lot of fun, not just, you know, creating something that's going to be here well beyond my lifetime, but more importantly for me to be able to work with my dad.
A couple of questions about that business. Well, number one, I had a friend who was up at the Greenbrier last weekend, and I asked him, and he did not know the answer. There was that project that was going on with Trevino and Palmer and Player and your dad, all four designing that. And with Arnold's passing, I'm wondering, where does that project stand now?
Arnold will have his design, his head design guy will be there and interact with Gary Lee and my dad now. So Arnold's input indirectly will still be there, and they're continuing on with that project.
And when one has a contract with the Jack Nicklaus Design Company, how much of a hands-on situation do they get from your dad?
If anybody has ever been part of that process, they'll know that it's complete hands-on with my dad. A lot of guys will just lend their name to a job. My dad would be the antithesis of that. He is, he loves it. He loves getting out there. He loves getting muddy. He loves being creative. He loves sharing ideas and thoughts with the developer and engineers. And he's out there with the guys that are pushing the dirt, that are sitting on the bulldozers, our design guys, which he's assembled an amazing, talented group of design associates and coordinators. And as a group, we kind of put our heads together, Dad being our leader, and he is completely hands-on. And, you know, I was talking about it with my mom today. My dad will promise, you know, one level, but always tries to over-deliver on that promise. That's just the way he's wired. And literally, he is out there, you know, a lot.
Jack Nicklaus II is our guest taking Dead Aim on America's Pulse 1660. Get you out of here with a couple of questions about where you are right now at Muirfield Village. I saw you earlier this week in the ceremony with Greg Norman, and I really love all the things that they do up at that tournament at the Memorial. Can you just describe how special a place? You mentioned that it was an early design. It was 1974, but it seems to have a very special place in the heart of your father and your family. Can you describe the feeling Muirfield Village has for you?
It's a home away from home. Mom and Dad, when I think about it, it's incredible what they have created here when you think about the age. So 1968, my dad and three friends, there's four that founded the club here: Pandle Savick, Ivor Young, Bob Hogan, my dad. They were at Augusta National during one of the competitions there. They were sitting at a lunch table together, and they said, you know what, we really should try to do something like this for our hometown back in Columbus, Ohio. Let's give back to Columbus, something that's been so special to our lives. So anyway, they bought this property in 1968. My dad is 28 years old at the time, I have a son that's 27 right now. Just for me, it's unbelievable that, you know, he could have that foresight to, you know, get a piece of property and try to create something, give it back to his hometown. Well, he went on, and this golf course was really the first golf course built as a stadium-type golf course. His membership, the first 10 members, honorary members, he went to Japan. He got an Asian member. He got a black member. He got a female member. He tried to be as diverse as he could well before anybody talked about diversity. He's doing this at now. He's doing this as a 32-year-old young man. And of course, now here we are, 40 some years later, and he's created a tournament that the best players in the world come to. It's played on a facility that is second to none, Muirfield Village Golf Club. And the players love coming here because I think my mom and dad took what they've learned throughout the years of traveling around the tour, and they've implemented it here. They've got, a great child care services. They have, how they handle the players coming in and coming out, they make it as easy as they can for these guys to perform at their best level. And going beyond that, giving back to the community, there's over 100 local charities that benefit from the tournament each year. From inception, we've given close to $27 million. This year, we'll shell out about $2.5 million to the lion's share going to Nationwide Children's Hospital. So there's so many good things. It's not just golf. We're saving children's lives, and it's something that mom and dad have created. And again, I don't know if I mentioned, but honoring golfers of the past, greats of the past. We honored Greg Norman this year, and Greg gave a wonderful talk yesterday about, growing up and learning the game of golf through reading my dad's books, as a matter of fact, 55 Ways to Play Golf and Golf My Way, the two books that he received from his father, I think, when he was 15 years old. And, there's so many little stories that I could tie into. I can go on and on, but it's a very, very special place.
All right, let's get out of here with the most important question about Muirfield Village. You're old enough to remember the old International that was at Castle Pines in Colorado.
Sure.
And that golf club was famous for one thing and one thing only, and that was its milkshakes. And lately, I'm hearing a lot of smack being talked about the brilliance of the Muirfield Village milkshake.
It's really good.
Putting all bias aside, which is the better milkshake?
Well, I actually played in the International for a couple of years, several years back before electricity. And
well, there was enough electricity in the skies out there.
But anyway, no, there has always been a fun competition. Actually, that they do a player poll. And one of the questions is, where are the best milkshakes on tour? And one and two went back and forth for many years between Castle Pines in Colorado and here at Muirfield Village Golf Club. And my vote goes to Muirfield Village in the Memorial Tournament. I actually had one 2 days ago. My wife's all over me. I had a little heart procedure a couple weeks ago, so I'm eating so much lettuce I'm going to turn into a manatee, I think. But I had a Buckeye milkshake, which is the chocolate and peanut butter, and they added a little bit of malt and just the richest, creamiest ice cream, and it was good. That was a treat. I hope she's not listening to this this interview because she'll know that I eat a milkshake.
Like I said, he is much, much more than just the greatest of all time's eldest son. That's Jack Nicklaus II. I hope you enjoyed hearing our conversation with him again. And from country music superstar and Jordan Spieth's pro-am partner, Jake Owen. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast on Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Weather-wise, well, here in the Queen City, we should be okay to play all weekend, even though it may get a little chilly on Sunday. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management. Like I said, he is much, much more than just the greatest of all time's eldest son. That's Jack Nicklaus II. I hope you enjoyed hearing our conversation with him again. And from country music superstar and Jordan Spieth's pro-am partner, Jake Owen. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast on Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Weather-wise, well, here in the Queen City, we should be okay to play all weekend, even though it may get a little chilly on Sunday. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management.